Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. On a day when the South Carolina legislature voted to take down the Confederate flag, we'll begin with the shouting and jeering in the House of Representatives as Republicans try to add an amendment to protect Confederate flags in national cemeteries. Michael Lind, a co-founder of the New America Foundation and author of Land of Promise, an economic history of the United States, joins us to discuss how the ghosts of the Confederacy haunt our politics today, while the feudal Southern economic model that the Civil War was fought to expunge is alive and well today in the right-to-work states of the South. Then we'll analyze the testimony of the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs before the Senate, where Marine General Joseph Dunford called Russia's recent actions nothing short of alarming and went on to say that Russia posed an existential threat to the United States. Kimberly Martin, a professor of political science at Barnard College and a member of Columbia University's Harriman Institute, joins us to discuss the dangerous consequences of the U.S. providing Ukraine with lethal weapons, which General Dunford said was a reasonable thing to do. Then finally, we'll examine Jeb Bush's remarks in New Hampshire that people need to work longer hours to make America more productive. Sylvia Allegretto, a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley, joins us to discuss how out of touch Jeb Bush is with the realities facing working Americans, particularly when his super PAC just released its latest fundraising numbers between January and June, totaling more than $103 million. And according to the Bush campaign, Jeb made $28.5 million between 2007, when he left the Florida governorship, and 2013. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics and the American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
And you'd think from what happened in the House of Representatives today that the Civil War was still happening. There was screaming and shouting and jeering over an amendment that was put into an Interior Department bill where Republicans tried to add an amendment that would protect the Confederate flag in national cemeteries. And we've had, of course, the massacre in the AME church down in South Carolina and the fact that the South Carolina legislature finally voted to remove the Confederate flag. So given all that's going on, what's your sense of how the ghosts of the Confederacy are still stalking our politics?
Well, I think there are two things in tension here. And I should say I'm a Southerner, a fifth-generation Texan, and a descendant of Southerners just in general since the early 1600s. So, you know, my family's Southern. I grew up there, and I understand it reasonably well. I think the tension is between the Southern political and economic heritage, which is pretty awful, legacy of racism, but even more importantly of cheap labor and oligarchic politics. So there's that political and economic legacy, but there's also the cultural identity of white Southerners, you know, many of whom have lived in areas where there, you know, it wasn't part of the so-called Black Belt with the plantation agriculture, particularly the Scots-Irish in Appalachia and in the Ozarks. And the problem is that the Southern elite has essentially defined Southern identity in terms of the 4 years of the Civil War, and also more generally in terms of the system of exploiting blacks for their labor, because it's primarily an economic system. It's a labor exploitation system. And so Southern whites don't have any symbols of their own folk identity, which in itself is just as legitimate as anybody else's ethnic identity, you know, Polish Americans or Irish Americans or Mexican Americans. And to me, that's kind of what's being missed here, because there were always two Souths. There was the Upland South, which was settled by people from Ulster and from the northern British border, from the Appalachia through down through the Ozarks. quite distinct from the plantation belt, where the upper class was English. And the Anglo-American Southern elite always looked down on the Scots-Irish. And because they were illiterate, and they tended to be very poor, the poorest group of white Americans, they were victims of the Southern system, not as much as blacks were. Obviously, they had white skin privilege, but they were victims of the system to a lesser extent. And they never really had an identity of their own, because you have to be literate, and you have to have your own class of intellectuals to define your identity. And so the two identities of a lot of working-class white Southerners were provided by the evangelical Protestant church and by this cult of the Confederacy being a project of the Southern upper class, not of the lower classes, and the whole system of white supremacy, to the extent that it was a labor system, also benefited the upper class in the South, not most white Americans. Except to some degree they benefited, but it was essentially an elite project.
So would you therefore say that racism and slavery and hatred and exploitation of blacks, it was a way in many ways to distract these poor white Southerners from the fact that, that at any moment they could be replaced by slaves? In other words, they were fighting a war to essentially allow the plantation owner to replace them with slaves.
Well, that's right, but this was not lost on a lot of them. The most intense resistance to the Confederate government, measured by desertion or even by people fighting in the Union Army, tended to be in the poor upper, you know, highland areas of the South. So there's always this tension. And northern liberals who make fun of the stupid hillbillies and the inbred rednecks and so on, they're going after the wrong targets, because there's always been a divide within the Highland South among the poorer, mostly Scots-Irish whites, between those who hate the Southern landlords more than they hate the Yankees and vice versa. But let me just say, I think when people talk about racism or slavery being the original sin of the South, they get it wrong. It's actually cheap labor is the original sin of the South, because if you go back to the settlement of the Southern colonies in the 17th century, they were settled by upper-class and patrician Englishmen who wanted to create a kind of manorial feudal society like the ones back in Southern England. And in order to do that, to have this rentier existence of living off of the labor of others, they needed a workforce. And slavery came fairly late in the 17th century. They initially, the settlers in Virginia and the other Southern colonies from Britain initially tried indentured servants from England and Scotland and Ireland, but they could run away. And they weren't easily identifiable. You know, they tried to get the American Indians to work for them, and that didn't work either, because they could run away. And so from the Spanish and the Portuguese, they adopted this institution of African slavery, but it's the economic system that came first, this system of semi-feudal plantation agriculture.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who's a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is the author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, The American Way of Strategy, and What Lincoln Believed. And his latest book is Land of Promise and Economic History of the United States. And clearly, the Tories, the British aristocrats, it's no surprise that they supported the South in the Civil War. But just to go back to the fact that today in Congress was one of the most boisterous days, with shouting and jeering over this issue of a rider that was put in at the last minute by this fellow, Representative Ken Calvert, here out here in Riverside, California, who chairs the House Appropriations Subcommittee with jurisdiction over the Interior Department. He says that he put this in at the request of some Southern members of the Republican caucus to protect the Confederate flag in national cemeteries. I mean, I know it may seem tangential, but since I know who this fellow is, Calvert, he's probably the most corrupt guy in the Congress. He was caught a few years back with a hooker in possession of of cocaine or heroin. He's a former real estate developer who still keeps his real estate business going. And it's just, it's hard to know where the ideology ends and corruption begins.
I think it may be sincere, you know, because, see, the difference between the South and the rest of the country is there was very little immigration to the South until after World War II, and then more recently from other parts of the world. So the vast people moved within the South, like my ancestors would move from Virginia and you know, Tennessee and Alabama to Texas. So people in the South, you know, remembered, most white Southerners until recently had ancestors who fought in the Civil War, and you knew about it. Whereas if you're a German-American or a Polish-American, you just don't know that much about your, you know, maybe it goes back to your grandparents, but before that you don't know it. So there is this whole sense of history. And the way white Southerners managed to reconcile their American patriotism with this Confederate nostalgia for about 100 years was to pretend that both sides had somehow been right, that the South had been right about states' rights and that the North had been right about union. And so this reunion that took place between the regions essentially sacrificed African Americans. And it also rewrote history to say that the Civil War was not primarily about slavery when that was exactly what it was about. And I've had the experience with older white Southerners of really shocking them, you know, because they were brainwashed in the Southern school system to think that slavery and racism had nothing to do with the Confederacy. And then I'll show them documents like the Texas Ordinance of Secession, which is just this long, you know, Nazi-sounding rant about the inferiority of the black race to the white race must be preserved and so on. And that's what they're saying secession is about, and they're voting for it. That Lincoln is a threat to the white race.
Well, but even, but Michael...
go ahead.
So I was going to say, but even using the word slavery, it doesn't do justice to the crime against humanity that it involved, the brutality, the fact that that human beings were chattel, they were disposable. I was looking the other night at the PBS show on the abolitionists, and I had no idea that how brutal and relentless the slave owners were in pursuing slavery. And when the West was opened up in California, they tried to expand all of those states to be slave states, and they made
it. You can go beyond that because de facto slavery was not really prosecuted by the federal government until the 1930s and 40s. And with illegal immigration, you have a form of de facto slavery in many cases. So all the way up until the 1920s and 1930s, the Southern landlords and their corporate partners, who were often Northern corporations and Northern investors, they had all kinds of unfree labor systems. So you had the convict lease system, in which people would be rounded up on spurious charges in many cases. Sometimes they commit crimes, sometimes they're just loitering, sent to jail or to prison. And then the warden would lease them out, to some Yankee corporation, which is, you know, clearing timber on some local landlord's land, that sort of thing. There was debt tenancy. There was sharecropping. But the point is, obviously it was a racist system. The racism was essential to keeping the non-elite whites and the elite whites together. But it was primarily a labor system, and so a lot of poor whites were sharecroppers, and a lot of the poor whites were trapped in this system where they were arrested on phony charges. You see this in Ferguson, right? So it turned out in Ferguson that the police were using these trumped-up charges deliberately to extort revenue from the poor blacks in the city. That was their actual business model. And that has a long, long history in the South and in the border states, where you're essentially framing innocent people, black or otherwise, in order to say that once they're arrested, they have to work off their debt or their fine by essentially being slaves. And that system lasted all the way. It was really the fact of the Nazis and, you know, Japanese wartime slavery and so on finally embarrassed the conscience of the United States. And then, of course, there's the Civil Rights Revolution. But so even de facto African-American slavery and versions of unfree servitude for white Southerners survived the Civil War for many decades.
Well, there's no question, Michael Lind, that the economic model of feudalism operates in the South. There was just a piece, I think it was on John Oliver's HBO show that I was watching about Tyson Chicken, how they get all of these Southern landowners, I mean, farmers, you know, poor people, basically, to invest in huge expenses to build big chicken coops for factory farm chickens, and Tyson supplies the chickens but completely controls these people, and they end up being complete slaves and having no independence and being totally at the mercy. Most of them are being driven into bankruptcy just out of pure greed. And you know, we know that these states are also right-to-work states. So,
Well, that's why the progressive Southerners, including Lyndon Johnson, who's slowly getting his due over time, Henry Clay, you know, even George Washington, even Lincoln was a Southerner. He's from Kentucky. They realized that there was no Southern solution for Southern oppression. That is, ultimately, it had to be a national solution. So on one thing after another, the only way you can make a race to the bottom cheap labor strategy unprofitable is to have a national minimum wage. And Franklin Roosevelt and his allies in the North, they actually, and in the South too, they saw the federal minimum wage as a way of putting these, you know, a lot of Southern labor exploitation out of business. I mean, unfortunately, it's not high enough. And the same is true for benefits. See, what people don't realize about the welfare state is, far from creating dependency, it actually creates more bargaining power and more independence from your employer. Because if you can quit your job, and you're not going to be bankrupt, and you're not going to lose your health care, and it's not a total disaster, but then you're going to be much more uppity, to use a Southern expression, with your boss, right? Mm-hmm. So the whole Southern cheap labor system depends not only on low wages, but on low benefits. And the benefits have to be set by the state government, not by Washington, D.C., not because they love localism and all of that nonsense. It's because the Southern state government's business model for a century, since the New South after the Civil War, has been to deliberately keep wages and benefits low while outlawing unions. So you can then, if I can use the word, pimp your poor people to outside investors who were originally in New York and in Britain. But now increasingly they're in Germany and Japan, the former Axis powers, who are opening up all of these cheap labor factories in you know, the poor parts of the South, particularly the poor white parts of the South. So that way, you know, the Europeans and Asians have their own outsourcing capitalists, right? So the German capitalists who don't want to pay unionized BMW workers, they can open up, you know, these factories in the poorest, most benighted, backward areas of Appalachia, right? And that's why we've got this Japanese and German and Korean-funded second automobile belt in the U.S., which has pretty much killed off the unionized factory belt in Detroit.
So the fact that so many of these Republican Southern politicians are so adamant against the Affordable Care Act, because it doesn't make any sense. You think that the foreign capitalists like Volkswagen and these other German and Japanese car companies taking the healthcare burden off them would be a plus, but nevertheless...
But you've got to remember, the problem with the Affordable Care Act is, it's true that the Medicaid expansion is initially funded almost entirely by the federal government. And, you know, maybe that could be made permanent. But what the Southern state conservatives are thinking is, well, in a few years, we're going to have to raise taxes to pay for our share of this Medicaid expansion. And that will undercut our ability to go to California and to New York and say, you know, we're a cheap, low tax, low service, low welfare state, you know, with cheap labor. So come move to us the way Rick Perry did in Fripp's trying to gather business. So, you know, it's a coherent mm-hmm. business model.
Well, but there's a spiteful aspect to it, where the one of the biggest landowners in the state of Tennessee, this congressman, is also the one leading the charge to take people off food stamps when he gets the biggest agricultural subsidies in the state. So, it's,
yeah, but it's all part of the what I call Southernomics. The poorer and the more dependent on state officials and state charity your workforce is, the less likely they are to be able to demand higher wages. And if they demanded higher wages, you know, then you would have to, you know, have a different economic model, which, by the way, does exist in the South. So I've been beating up on the South. But there is an alternate model. It's what I call the Sun Belt model. And it was that of the New Deal Southerners, some of whom were racist, but many of whom were social liberals. And the Sun Belt model is the reverse of this. That is, you have national entitlements. So you take control over benefits out of the hands of the oligarchs in the state capital. You have national minimum wage. You have federally financed public investment in productivity-enhancing infrastructure. You have support for universities, R&D. So, you know, it's not the Sahara, the Bozard. I mean, there's this battle is going on within the South between the old South model of cheap labor smokestack chasing and this Sun Belt model, you know, of public investment and university-driven growth.
Well, Michael Lind, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and The American Way of Strategy, and What Lincoln Believed. And his latest book is Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're looking into the testimony of the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs before the Senate today.
You've been born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in their game.
From Russia with love I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kimberly Martin, who is a professor of political science at Barnard College and a member of the Columbia University's Harriman Institute and Saltzman Institute for War and Peace. Her books include Enforcing the Peace, Learning from the Imperial Past, Weapons, Culture, and Self-Interest, Soviet Defense Managers in the New Russia, and Engaging the Enemy, Organization Theory and Soviet Military Innovation. Her latest book is Warlords, Strong-Arm Brokers in Weak States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kimberly Martin.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be back.
And Kimberly, in the confirmation hearings on Thursday before the United States Senate, the new chairman, or he will be the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Marine General Joseph Dumford, called Russia's recent actions nothing short of alarming, and went on to say, so if you want to talk about a nation that could pose an existential threat to the United States, I have to point to Russia. How does that strike you?
I think both of those things are true, in that what is happening in Russia's actions towards the outside world is indeed alarming, and that Russia is indeed a potential existential threat to the United States, because it's the only country at this point that could destroy U.S. territory with nuclear weapons that are left over from the Cold War. But I think it's important that we keep things in context. There's been some statements made today that Russia is the biggest threat facing the United States. And I don't think that's correct, because the biggest cyber threat that we have had evidence of coming from any state is coming from China. The biggest threat to homeland security is probably the Islamic State and the recruiting that it's trying to do of American citizens. And, you know, when we think about Russian actions in Ukraine, they're very disturbing, but Ukraine is not a member of NATO. And so while there's lots of potential for Russia to threaten NATO partners, so far that hasn't actually happened at any significant level.
Well, I think you could argue on the cyber threat that we are already in a kind of cyber cold war with China. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more going on a regular basis than we know about. We never learn about what the U.S. is doing in retaliation. But, you know, the fact that they recently broke into the Office of Personnel, the Federal Office of Personnel, that has all of the resumes of every American spy from the whole gamut of the alphabet soup of spy agencies. It's extraordinary how aggressive the Chinese have been.
Right.
So, but the bottom line for you, though, is that we may have psychological disarmament since the Cold War, but physically the nuclear weapons still are pointed at each other.
Yes, they are. On both sides. The nuclear confrontation at a physical level never ended, and it's easy to forget that sometimes.
So in terms of what else was said in the hearings at, before the Senate on the confirmation of the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Marine General Joseph Dunford, he was asked by senators about Ukraine and arming Ukraine, and he said that he thought providing lethal weapons to Ukraine was a reasonable move. And quoting him, frankly, without that kind of support, they are not going to be able to defend themselves against Russian aggression. So does this mean that there will be an escalation in...
Well, you know, we've been hearing talk like this for many months coming from basically a whole variety of actors in the United States outside of the Obama administration, and even with some individuals in the Obama administration expressing that viewpoint. But the decision has not yet been made by Obama himself. And, you know, it's a very complicated issue. Ukraine, as I mentioned, is not a NATO member state, and so there is no legal obligation for the United States to provide weapons to Ukraine. And more than that, I think we have to consider really carefully what the logic of providing those weapons would be. You know, I was in Ukraine with a group of people visiting a number of cities and talking to a number of politicians and academics and journalists and so forth back in May. And one thing that's very clear is that people there are getting very war-weary. They are tired of the fighting. They are more concerned about what's happening in domestic politics and the economy in Ukraine. And they're not necessarily against some kind of a resolution to the current question. And so sometimes the Ukrainian nationalism that we hear is played up by the Ukrainian-American community and the Ukrainian-Canadian community more than it is coming actually from the Ukrainian community that lives in Ukraine. So that's one important thing to keep in mind. The other thing to think about is that the evidence that we have is that Putin's military has real limits on its ability to move very much forward in what it's doing because of morale problems in the Russian military, because of, you know, the financial problems that Russia is now facing and the incredible risks that he would be taking in losing if he keeps on going further. But if the United States were to become more involved in Ukraine, those physical limits would probably stop mattering as much because it would really justify Putin's statement that had been made in the last few months, that the conflict in Ukraine isn't really about Ukraine. It really isn't about ethnicity or any of the things he talked about earlier, that the conflict in Ukraine is really about the United States threatening Russia's borders. And so I think that by arming Ukraine with heavy weapons, the United States would essentially be just feeding into Putin's rhetoric and actually would give Putin more political strength. And a final thing to think about, and this was reinforced by what I learned in Ukraine, is that the Ukrainian military is a mess. It is corrupt. It is filled with people who are potentially actually agents on behalf of the Russians. It is cooperating with all kinds of informal militia groups that are not really under centralized state control. And so in that sense, sending weapons to Ukraine means that the United States doesn't really know what it would be getting into. It would be very difficult to control what happened to those weapons, where they were used, whether they might end up being sold on the international market, whether they would fall into the hands of the Russians. And so what we have to ask ourselves is, do we have evidence that given the level of problems in the Ukrainian military and the politics of what's happening in Russia, is it really worthwhile for the United States to get involved that way in an area where Ukraine is not our military ally in any legal sense?
And again, I'm speaking with Kimberly Martin, who's a professor of political science at Barnard College and a member of Columbia University's Harriman Institute and Saltzman Institute for War and Peace. Her books include Weapons, Culture, and Self-Interest, Soviet Defense Managers in the New Russia, and Engaging the Enemy, Organization Theory and Soviet Military Innovation. And her latest book is Warlords, Strong-Arm Brokers in Weak States. I think, though, your point's well taken, Kimberly, in terms of Ukraine. It's clear that recently Putin made Russian casualties in Ukraine a state secret. So he's clearly concerned about the Russian people learning about the extent of Russian involvement in Ukraine. And if he were to escalate, there would be more body bags. But it seems to me that, you know, at a certain point, there are limits to Russia's military, even though now is the season for fighting in the summer, because at some point or other, you know, he's going to, and they should know this lesson from World War II, that he's going to be faced with kind of guerrilla warfare the more territory he takes. And my understanding is that, as you say, the Ukrainians aren't as hateful and towards the Russians as perhaps the diaspora in the United States and Canada is. But nevertheless, things have changed, I think. I think the Russians have lost the Ukrainians in terms of hearts and minds, shall we say. And my sense is that Putin's real strategy is to destroy the Ukrainian economy, which is teetering on the brink in any case.
I think you're exactly right. But, you know, what people say is when we're looking at Russia and things that might go wrong in Russia, August is the month to watch. That's when the intervention in Georgia happened a few years ago. That's when the coup attempt against Gorbachev was launched way back at the end of the Soviet period. There is, you know, increasing evidence that just keeps on coming and coming of a Russian military buildup along the Ukrainian border and of more troops and more weapons flowing into Ukraine. So I think you're also exactly right that in the summer fighting season, if something is going to happen, it's going to happen in August. But there truly are limits on how far Putin can go. And so an expansion of the fighting doesn't necessarily mean that a significantly greater geographical area beyond, the current area in the Donbass would actually be something that the Russians were capable of seizing.
But my understanding is that the Ukrainians aren't, since the Russians occupy the Donbass, they're basically cutting off all pensions, et cetera, and payments.
They have been.
And the people are really suffering.
That's absolutely true. And there's been a huge outflow of refugees. And a big concern among many people in Europe is what happens if the war expands, because it would mean that there'd be an even larger Ukrainian refugee population and migrant population that would be further contributing to all of the political debates that are going on right now in Europe about the migrant population that's coming from the southern area in the Arab world. So it's a very difficult set of problems.
But is Putin picking up the tab for the people in the areas that he is?
No, I mean there's very limited Russian humanitarian support. It's televised a lot when it happens, but it is certainly not enough to take care of the problems in the area.
Right. So is he on any kind of learning curve? Crimea has cost him a lot. The Donbass, he may be hanging those people out to dry that he supposedly liberated.
My take on Putin is that what he's mostly concerned about is domestic politics, and so he is going to do whatever plays best to the domestic audience, and that means that he's likely to be very limited in how much further he goes in Ukraine as long as there is not evidence of an increasing U.S. involvement. But the problem is that if the U.S. were to get more involved in the situation, then Putin would have the kind of standing to say to his domestic population, I have been keeping this a secret because it was necessary all along, but yes, our boys are fighting and dying in Ukraine, and they're doing it to keep the United States away from Russian borders. So I think we need to be most aware of the domestic political calculus that goes into Putin's decision-making.
So what's your sense of what kind of advice Obama is getting then? He's holding the line. He hasn't made the decision.
Right.
He's obviously
I think Obama is making the right decision.
Which is not to...
Which is not to expand our involvement in Ukraine to include weapons deliveries.
But the hearings today from the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the kind of questions are being asked, and we know it's going to become an issue in the presidential election.
Oh, yes, certainly. And I keep on waiting for the decision to change and for the U.S. to start sending weapons to Ukraine, because it has been increasingly on the political agenda since at least late last fall. So it may happen sometime soon.
But if we do supply weapons, that of course would be in effect a blessing for Putin. On the other hand, you mentioned that there's a lot of Russian agents that have infiltrated the Ukrainian military, not to mention the fact that...
Yes, several thousand of them have been arrested, and that makes you wonder how many others there might be.
Right. And then you've got all of these oligarchs, even with their own private militias. Now you've got Chechen Islamists in there, too.
Exactly. So, I mean, basically, the Ukrainian fighters are accepting anybody who is effective as an ally. And the problem with having the militias come in is that they can be very militarily effective, but then what happens when the fighting stops? Are they just going to go home? Are they not going to try to have any influence on the government in Kyiv? I think we are really facing the danger in Ukraine, and we have been for over a year, of the growth of local warlords, people who will continue to have significant political influence in the areas where they're located when the war ends, because of the role that they had in fighting and their ability to control fighters.
So, in effect, you'll have a Syria right there in the middle of Eastern Europe.
I hope it doesn't get that bad.
but the picture you're painting is similar to what's happening in Syria.
Yeah, it is.
So, let's return to the question of diplomacy, which is not necessarily on the table here. We know that President Obama and Putin, for the longest time, used to have long phone conversations. Apparently, a lot of the time was just basically trying to argue with Putin's worldview, which is apparently quite unique. And this is also buttressed by what Angela Merkel has said about her conversations with him. But my understanding is that Obama's basically given up on him. He doesn't talk to him anymore.
Well, there was a phone call from Putin to President Obama a week or so ago, I think.
For was the it 4th around of July? Yeah, it was a 4th of July greeting. Yeah.
So there is still some communication, and my understanding is that after many months of being reluctant to do it, the Obama administration is once again willing to speak to Russia at a military-to-military level to talk about avoiding dangerous military activities when it's possible. So there's some communication that's happening. I'm not sure how significant it is, but the door is not completely closed.
But in terms of nuclear arms, we started out talking about the fact that Russia is the only country. China does have nuclear weapons, but Russia's weapons are...
Russia has a lot more than China does.
And they are aimed at the U.S. And presumably the U.S. weapons are also aimed at Russia. But Putin recently announced that he would add 40 new intercontinental nuclear missiles to his arsenal. And according to the State Department, Russia's violated the 1987 treaty by testing an intermediate-range missile.
Yes. And that's significant for more than just the military value, because the signing of the INF Treaty was really the step that marked the beginning of the end of the Cold War. What was so significant about the INF Treaty is that for the first time there was on-site inspection. Up until that point, arms control had always relied on overhead satellite flights, and that meant that there was a real limit on what could be controlled, because it would obviously be the only thing the satellites could count were big objects rather than objects that were inside buildings or objects, the question of for example, how many actual, warheads were inside the missiles, and so that encouraged both sides to have more missiles inside a smaller number of rockets, because the overhead satellite flights couldn't find out what the real situation was. And so the really significant thing about 1987 was that there was on-site inspection on both sides, and that it was eliminating an entire class of nuclear weapons, which had never happened before. Ending that or violating that treaty is sending a very strong political message beyond the military component, which is that Putin is undoing the end of the Cold War.
Well, that was, of course, the opening wedge, if you will, the nose of the camel that unraveled the Cold War and ended it with the SS-20 versus the Pershing deal. And the Russians were concerned about the Pershing intermediate missiles because it took about 6 to 8 minutes to get to Moscow, and they were mobile and hidden. And they are the most dangerous weapons out there. And to bring them back is pretty alarming.
Yeah, it really is.
So where do we stand on that? I mean, we've had an arms control bureaucracy forever. Is it moribund, or is it all about who Putin is?
I think it all depends on Putin. And, the thing that was really sad is that in January, Yevgeny Primakov, who's a former prime minister, former head of the intelligence services in Russia, longtime analyst of international relations, came out and gave a public speech in Moscow where he essentially said that there are more important things in global security that require U.S.-Russian cooperation than what we're doing in Ukraine. And he named especially the fight against terrorism, but also talked about the possibility of nuclear confrontation. Now, you know, Primakov passed away just a few weeks ago, but there's no evidence that Putin paid any attention to what Primakov said. And Primakov was no softy. He was pretty much a hardliner. He was very much a realist in the tradition of Henry Kissinger. He was somebody who drove hard bargains and wasn't afraid to take a stand on issues, including on Kosovo. But he was somebody who believed that even though there was such a high level of confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union and the United States and Russia, that there were really significant areas where negotiation and compromise were possible for the sake of international security. And it really is too bad that Putin is choosing to ignore Primakov's message on that.
Well, but Putin's hollowed out the entire professional class, whether they're entrepreneurs in business or in the Academy of Sciences, in all of the government bureaucracies like Primakov, and he's just got his Siloviki, the cronies, looting the place around the clock. It's tragic what's happened to that country.
Yeah.
I thank you for joining us, Kimberly. I wish we could have a more cheerful subject, but this is how it is.
Okay, thank you, Ian, anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Kimberly Martin, who's a professor of political science at Barnard College and a member of Columbia University's Harriman Institute and Saltzman Institute for War and Peace. Her books include Weapons, Culture, and Self-Interest, Soviet Defense Managers in the New Russia, and Engaging the Enemy, Organization Theory, and Soviet Military Innovation. And her latest book is Warlords, Strong Arm Brokers in Weak States. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining Jeb Bush's remarks that people need to work longer hours.
Talk, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Silvia Allegretta, who is a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. Welcome to Background Briefing, Silvia Allegretta.
It's nice to be with you, Ian.
And Sylvia, just on Wednesday in New Hampshire, at an editorial meeting of the editors of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Jeb Bush was talking about how America has to be, we have to have a more productive workforce. And he went on to say, it means that people need to work longer hours and through their productivity, gain more income for their families. That's the only way we're going to get out of this rut that we're in. First of all, the rut that we're in doesn't affect Jeb Bush and people like him. He made $28.5 million between 2007, the year he left office, and 2013. And his super PAC that's raising money for his presidential race reported raising more than $103 million between January the 6th and June the 30th. So what did you make of his remarks?
Well, I mean, we know for sure that the wealthy right now are doing very, very well. Wall Street is booming. CEO pay is back to where it was. All these politicians are able to amass fortune. I was discouraged at what he said. He basically said that, you know, the average worker has to work more hours and increase productivity, which is what we've been doing for decades now, especially, you know, family hours of work, women entering the labor force. So family hours of work have been increasing enormously over the last decade, as too has been productivity. So what has happened? Well, we know what has happened since the mid-70s. We have what we have called this productivity wage and compensation gap. More productive workers are, in fact, not gaining in those productivity gains. The wages are not being wages are not being passed to workers as they become more productive. So where is the increased productivity and the increase in the economic pie that has been occurring over these last decades? Disproportionately, it's going, we know, to the top of the very top, not just the top 1%, but the top 0.01%. So, in the long run, we have exactly what he's talking about, but the problem is that we don't have, we have increased inequality, and we don't have the average typical workers gaining in the productivity and increased economic pie. In the short run, he wants these hours increase. Well, here in California, unemployment is, official unemployment is 6.4%, much higher than the 5.3% in the rest of the country. We're 6 years into a very weak, still weak economic recovery, and many people would like to be working more, but there aren't jobs or there's not an ability to increase their hours. And again, this goes directly to, economic policy that, helped drag our feet into this recovery lasting so long in such a weak state.
Well, but just in terms of facts, not that facts necessarily mean a lot nowadays, because all these, he who spins the truth best wins the argument, unfortunately. But just in terms of facts about the hours that Americans work, according to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the U.S. is fourth behind Mexico, Russia, and Hungary in terms of the number of hours that we work, which is average is 1,789 hours. Japan is 1,729. Canada, 1,704. Mm-hmm. The UK, 1,677. Germany, 1,371. Full-time workers in America average 47 hours per week, and 18% of American workers work more than 60 hours a week. Also, right. Americans have the fewest number of holidays than any of their European counterparts. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 2014, U.S. workers averaged 16 allotted days of vacation, and only 25% of U.S. workers took all the time off they were given, while 15% took no vacation time at all. So how can he say that we're not working hard enough?
Yes, U.S. workers are extremely productive and work very hard. And as you mentioned, we're the only developed, advanced country in the world that doesn't have any mandated vacation time. Your employer just gives you vacation from the goodness of their heart. I mean, you could be a full-time worker, or part-time worker, whatever, and get absolutely no vacation day or very few vacations. And as you mentioned, many people who do get vacations don't even use them in the U.S., which seems crazy, but because we are working so hard, because now with new technology, we can't seem to get away. And when we do get away, there's much evidence that we're still working, even on our vacations. We take our computers with us, we have our cell phones, we're constantly doing email. Yeah, I don't think one of the problems that the U.S. has is that we don't work hard enough or that we're not productive. We have some of the most productive workers in the world, and our productivity gains just are not being shared, and being afforded to those workers, which, by the way, was the case post-World War II. Moving into the mid-70s, productivity gains and wage and compensation gains for typical workers increased lockstep. And that's what economists said, well, that's a good thing. That's where we get increases in standards of living for all of the workforce and the country. But that, again, as I mentioned up in front, that broke away. We have this productivity, wage, and compensation split that started in the mid-70s, increased to what is now an ever-widening astronomical gap between the two. So I think Jeb Bush and other politicians like him would do more good to talk about how can we relink productivity and economic growth to increasing wages and family incomes for typical workers in the U.S. That's where the biggest problem is, which gets us back to what I believe is the biggest problem in the U.S. is inequality. The problem is that the gains of the economy simply aren't going to the majority of the workers that by and large are responsible for those gains. They're going to very, very wealthy people in the country.
And again, I'm speaking with Sylvia Allegretta, who's a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. And we're talking about Jeb Bush's statement that in New Hampshire on Wednesday to the New Hampshire Union Leader, the main newspaper up there, to the editors, that American workers need to work longer hours. And of course, this comes at a time when Jeb Bush made $28.5 million between 2007, the year he left the governorship of Florida, and 2013. And his super PAC just released its latest fundraising numbers, and Jeb Bush raised more than $103 million between January the 6th and June the 30th, which is about twice what Hillary Clinton has raised. And when you talk about vacations, which we were a second ago, the U.S. is way behind. France leads the way with 30 guaranteed mandated vacation days, followed by the U.K. with 28, Germany, Belgium, Australia, Switzerland mandate 20 days off, but that doesn't include paid national holidays. So, I mean, do you think that maybe, I mean, this remark reminds me of Mitt Romney's statements about the 47% or 46% of Americans are just a bunch of freeloaders. She's just made it so clear that this guy, Romney, was so out of touch with the average American. Jeb Bush's father, of course, in many ways lost the election to Bill Clinton because he didn't know anything about the price of milk and didn't know what a supermarket scanner was. Do you see that in that category? I mean, that this is just...
Absolutely, yeah. He seems completely out of touch with not just recent economic conditions. I wonder if he has any clue, for instance, that California, the biggest state and very important to our national economic situation, had 4 years of double-digit, consecutive month after month after month, 4 years of double-digit unemployment. And what a catastrophic situation that was for this state and this country. I mean, he seems completely unaware of that. And now it's like kind of blame the victim. I mean, he seems extremely off base here. And he also is talking about, in the same statement, he's talking about 4% growth, which would be fantastic. 4% growth quarter after quarter would be much higher than the 1% to 2% we've been getting recently. And it would be closer to full employment. That would mean that everybody has a job who wants a job. That would be fantastic. The problem is that we don't ever pursue the policies that actually get us to full employment. Workers in America would love that. Instead, we've been stagnating. We've had very weak economic growth. Again, we have unemployment that's far too high, especially in a state like California. And so we keep, fumbling along. His statement just simply didn't make any sense. And at worst, it was an affront to, the American workforce.
Well, we have 6.5 million Americans who, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, are working part-time for economic reasons. So it's not like people are, not looking for work and not trying to make ends meet and have several jobs. It's just that the jobs don't pay enough. I mean, wages have been flat in this country since the late 1970s. And
again, going back to the same problems that we've already talked about. And, that's exactly true. And again, he's completely off base if he thinks that, Americans need to work harder and longer. We've been doing that. The problem is they just don't benefit from those efforts. As you mentioned, the wages and family incomes especially in recent times, have been stagnating and at best and declining at worst, especially for the low-wage workforce.
So if Jeb Bush becomes president, with the Republicans controlling the House and the Senate, and if they and they already control the Supreme Court, the conservatives do, and they're very pro, they're corporatists, basically. They throw a bone to LGBT Americans, but at the end of the day, their rulings tend to be totally in favor of big corporations and big money. So if you have all branches of government controlled by the Republicans, to my mind, that's it could be the end of working America. I mean, you do these annual reports, the state of working America. Well, this will be a full-blown oligarchy, won't we, if this happens? I mean,
we definitely know what some of the policies will be. It will be more of the same. And it hasn't just been Republicans. The Clintons also definitely weighed in on tax breaks for wealthy, reforming policies that weren't in necessarily in the best light for working class people. The share of national income that's going to corporation is the highest ever on record. Well, the share going to workers and working families is a 60-year low. That just didn't happen overnight. It's happening because more and more, regardless of who is in power, they are not doing the bidding of working class America. There's too much money in politics, regardless of what party you're in. And I think that is the biggest problem, that we need to get back on track so we can reverse some of these trends that have been really decades in the making.
Well, I take it that I think it's pretty clear that the only person who's talking about the issues that we're discussing here today is Bernie Sanders. And he does seem to be resonating with a lot of people. He's drawing bigger crowds than any other politician so far in the race.
Well, Bernie, I think, is wonderful. And I have said more than once, if people are really paying attention, middle-class, working-class people, people who get up and go to work every day, if they're paying attention, I don't think that you can look at Bernie Sanders as anything but the person and perhaps the only person that is speaking for this group right now in politics. He's also picking up some of what Elizabeth Warren was doing. He wants regulation on banking. He wants, corporations to pay their fair share of taxes. He wants to up taxes on wealthy folks. He wants to make work pay. And that's exactly what we need to do. I hope that he keeps making a dent, at least in the discourse, as he has been. It's very exciting. For someone like me who's been speaking about inequality and what's been happening to workers for a long time, to hear somebody like Bernie Sanders get up there and tell it like it is.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sylvia Alegretta.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Sylvia Alegretta, who is a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.